This is 2RPH. I'm Jolyon Warwick-James, and you're listening to the Antiques Radio Show, bringing you a monthly kaleidoscope of things old, beautiful, or both, whether valuable or not. And in store today, we have for you problems with a Maori cloak. No problems with a Polynesian club, nor with a troublesome cricket bat. An interesting letter to the newspaper makes us ask again, what purpose museums serve, who needs them, and what for? Do they need to be centrally located, or even very accessible, and to whom? We hear about Edgar Allan Poe's pocket watch, problems with dealing in ivory objects, and a book review. And pornography. Does it make a good bedfellow with art? We hear from one person who thinks so. Add in some trivia, if that isn't trivia, and we bring you the Antiques Radio Show. And our first item was sufficiently topical to reach the front page of the Antiques Trade Gazette on the 14th of September. It's our troublesome Maori cloak. And the heading was Social Media Storm Stops Maori Cloak Sale. Sussex auction house Burstow and Hewitt has withdrawn a rare Maori cloak after its imminent sale was met by online threats and abuse, writes Roland Arkell. The chief's wearing blanket, or kākāhu, with colourful geometric decoration to the borders, has been owned by a local family for more than a century. An old handwritten paper label attached reads Maori mat worn by Chief Rewi when peace was declared between Maoris and Europeans after the Battle of Arakau. Auctioneer Mark Ellen said museums and institutions in New Zealand and international dealers had expressed serious interest in the piece that was scheduled to be sold in battle on September the 18th, when a conservative estimate of £3,000 to £5,000. However, after a New Zealand news channel reported the sale, aired on August the 30th, his firm was on the receiving end of a deluge of intimidation from trolling social media users. Ellen quickly made the decision to cancel the sale, inform the police, and return the cloak to the vendors, who have placed it in a bank vault while deciding how to proceed. And the article continues on page 6. The auction house has since received more constructive correspondence from various parties in New Zealand, and now a private sale that would see it returned to the Maori is a possibility. We're hopeful that between us and the vendors, we might get it back there, said Ellen. While significant Maori works are sold at UK auctions with some frequency, in 2017, a Porterino or bugle flute sold for £140,000 at John Nicholson's of Hazelmere, the cloak was deemed particularly sensitive given its association with a revered individual and a controversial moment in colonial history. To the Ngāti Maniapoto tribe, it's considered a sacred object or taonga. The warrior chief, Rewi Munga Maniapoto, who lived from 1807 to 1894, led resistance to the New Zealand government during the invasion of the Waikato region from July 1863 to April 1864. The last act of the conflict, the bloody defence of Arakau, was followed by widespread confiscation and sale of Maori lands to white settlers. While comments on social media suggested the cloak had been war booty, the family had traced its ownership back to New Zealand-born relative Elizabeth Chudley Grice, who lived from 1887 to 1960, and then to her father Thomas Grice, who spent time with Rewi in the years after the Maori Wars ended in 1872. Later in life, Rewi consented to sell land, received a government pension, and became a close friend of New Zealand governors Sir George Grey. Photographs of the chief taken in June 1879 depict him wearing a near-identical cloak. Made from flax and cotton with a dyed geometric border, Kākahu took up to 2 years to weave. This example kept folded in darkness for close to a century in a Georgian linen cupboard was in exceptional condition, retaining its bright colours to the borders. The cloak has been consigned close to a year ago without attribution before the family found its label and the history was researched. Burstow and Hewitt is currently in contact with social media channels in the hope of having the negative reviews and abuse removed from its digital profile. Thank you, Antique Trade Gazette. And if that all works out, that'll be a victory for everybody. And our next item, which also comes from the Pacific region, was slightly less problematic. It also comes from the Antique Trade Gazette, but from the 5th of October, and the headline is Polynesian War Club is a big hit in Salisbury. A tribal war club from the Marquesas Islands whose textbook provenance has sold for £71,000 at Woolley and Wallace. The UU, or head club, came for sale at the Salisbury Sales Room on September the 19th from the descendants of an early 19th century missionary. Elijah Armitage, 1781 to 1863, was a London Missionary Society member who travelled to the South Seas in 1821 to teach the spinning and weaving of cotton and the Christian message to the islands of Tahiti. He was there for 14 years, but ultimately deemed his efforts a failure. A textile factory he built on the Marquesas in 1824 was ransacked by locals, while in a letter to the Society penned in 1832, Armitage concluded that the islanders will not be disposed to labour much for the cloth, they do not think of making more until they are again in want, so that I have always had more new spinners than old ones. However, like many of his kind, Armitage did succeed in building up an extensive collection of artefacts from the local tribespeople. His diary records various transactions where examples of the local woodcarving culture were acquired in exchange for Western goods. The collection returned to the UK when Armitage was recalled in 1835, and much has been handed down through various branches of his family in the intervening years. Head clubs such as this, an indicator of warrior status that was used as both a ceremonial staff and a lethal weapon, have a history stretching back several thousand of years across Polynesia. They were a great inspiration for modern Western artists, including Paul Gauguin, who spent his final years on the Marquesas. The basis of this art is the human body or face, always the same thing and yet never the same thing, he remarked. European, American, and Australian bidders competed for this club via a bank of phones, those in the room and online having dropped out at around £30,000. It eventually sold to an Australian buyer at a sum that, with the addition of 25% buyer's premium, was just shy of £90,000. The estimate was £10,000 to £20,000. Will Hobbs, head of tribal art at William Wallace, said, "We're finding in general that the market for Polynesian art is on the rise." And continuing our clubbing, we bat on with another piece from the Antique Trade Gazette of the 28th of September. Anyone for cricket, incidentally? And the headline reads, "Banned bats welcomed at auction." The John Goodwin 15% buyer's premium sale room in Malvern offered what is dubbed probably the most notorious bat in cricket history in its June the 20th auction. The infamous bat used by Dennis Lilly in the 1979 to 1980 Ashes. Lilly had been persuaded by a friend that an aluminium bat inspired by baseball was a great idea. The Combat had previously been used in a game against the West Indies at Brisbane without incident, but on this occasion, at the Wacker Ground in Perth in December 1979, it sparked complaints not just from the opposition, but the Aussie captain Greg Chappell. After just four balls of the second day, Lily hit a straight drive down the ground, which failed to reach the boundary. Chappell, convinced that the ball should have been made the ropes, immediately asked 12th man Rodney Hogg to hand Lily a traditional bat. This was bluntly refused by Lily. In the meantime, England captain Mike Brearley complained to the umpire that the metal bat was damaging the ball. At this point, Chappell lost his patience and walked onto the ground to present Lily with a traditional willow bat. Lily then hurled the aluminium cricket bat into the air. He added three more runs to his total before being caught. The combat was subsequently banned. That bat used by Lily was offered at auction as part of the Duncan Fernley collection of cricket bats, several of which had been sold by the John Goodwin saleswoman in Worcestershire. Fernley, a cricketer who played for Worcestershire, he was later chairman, became a very successful manufacturer of bats. The company's heyday was in the 1980s, but it continued to make bats today on a smaller scale. It sold for a mid-estimate £5,200 via a phone bid to a private buyer against a local cricket enthusiast. And now, moving from cricket to a political football, we come to the letter page of the Sydney Morning Herald on the 23rd of October 2019. And this reignites the Powerhouse Museum issue. And this is a letter entitled Browsing History, and it comes from Kylie Winkworth of Newtown. Digitisation of the Powerhouse Museum's collection is welcome, but this may be the only benefit of wasting $1.5 billion to move the museum and its collection into smaller, less accessible and inferior facilities to those the Powerhouse already owns at Ultimo. The web does not replace the need for access to the real thing. Cramming the museum's collection into storage at Castle Hill will make it less accessible to the students and researchers who use the collection and the museum's library, both conveniently located in state-of-the-art facilities at Ultimo. And that letter in the Sydney Morning Herald raises again the question of for whom museums exist, and where they should be located, and to whom they should be accessible. You're listening to the Antiques Radio Show with Jolly and Warwick James on the 2RPH network. And now it's time to move on to something completely different. And what price an item that belonged to a famous person? Do you think a premium was paid for this particular pocket watch? And this comes from the Antique Trade Gazette of the 5th of October. And the headline is, Poe's Good Times Did Not Last. Though his works are now revered and highly valued in his native land, Edgar Allan Poe spent most of his writing life in debt. There were, however, a few months in the early 1840s when, while working in Philadelphia as an editor and contributor on Graham's magazine, he enjoyed some short-lived financial success. It was then that he treated himself to the French gold-cased pocket watch shown here, and it's pictured. Sadly, those good times did not last, and all too quickly the watch passed as collateral or in part payment with a valuation of $169 into the hands of one of his creditors, a local merchant tailor. Poe filed for bankruptcy in 1844 and moved to New York, where he died 5 years later. But his posthumous fame even led to a change in the watch's fortune. By the beginning of the 20th century, it had become a precious relic and over the years has changed hands a number of times. The most recent exchange took place at Christie's in New York, where on the 12th of June, the watch sold for $200,000. Then it was £157,480. That's getting close to $300,000, which is a lot to pay for a pocket watch. But then, not every pocket watch belonged to Edgar Allan Poe. Now here's something else to watch out for, And this item comes from the Antique Trade Gazette on the 5th of October. And you have to ask yourself, how does this help elephants? Headline, Pair Jailed After Illegal Export of Ivory Fans. Written by Alex Capon. Two men from South London have been sentenced for selling antique ivory fans on eBay to buyers in China and the US. The items were illegally exported without the required permits. Guy Buckle, 62, and Sik Hung Orr, 73, of Champion Hill, South East 5, London, were each sentenced to 28 months imprisonment at Inner London Crown Court on September the 23rd. They pleaded guilty to three counts of illegally exporting ivory goods in breach of the Customs and Excise Management Act, 1979. A police investigation established that 136 carved ivory fans, most of them 19th century Cantonese, had been exported outside the EU by the pair between January 2014 and November 2017, with the sales totalling £145,259. As antiques, the fans could be lawfully sold in the UK. However, Buckle and Orr made the majority of their sales to purchasers in China, Hong Kong and the US and dispatched the items without the necessary re-export permits issued by the Animal and Plant Health Agency. Permits would not have been issued as import bans on ivory have been in place in the US and China since 2017. The court heard how, in November 2017, the Met's Wildlife Crime Unit were contacted by the National Wildlife Crime Unit after two parcels destined for China were seized by the UK Border Force at Heathrow. The parcels each contained a carved ivory fan, and officers quickly identified the sender as a duo of online traders selling identical carved ivory items. When the pair's home address was searched in March 2018, a total of 291 carved ivory fans, all from protected or endangered species, and four pieces of unworked elephant ivory were seized. Detective Constable Sarah Bailey, who led the investigation, said, "There are legal requirements in relation to the sale of specimens derived from protected or endangered species, and these requirements had not been met in this case. I hope the sentencing highlights that this type of activity is illegal and acts as a deterrent to those involved in the illegal sale and export of such items." The pair were also in breach of eBay's self-imposed ivory ban, which has been in place for more than 10 years. And that item from the Antique Trade Gazette, I think, reminds us all that if you wish to take ivory from one country to another or to sell it, you need to be very, very careful what you do. And let's now turn to books. A lot went on between the wars. For example, Australia had a very short-lived assay office, testing and marking gold and silverwares. And then there was the Bauhaus, that combined craft and fine art style, which was founded by Walter Gropius and ran from approximately 1919 to 1933. And the Art newspaper of October 2019 has this book review written by Fiona McCarthy. It's entitled Walter Gropius, Visionary Founder of the Bauhaus, published by Faber and Faber, 560 pages and priced at £30. The 100th anniversary of the founding of the Bauhaus has prompted writers to explore this legendary art school and its impact. Biographer Fiona McCarthy has dedicated her latest book to the school's first director, the architect Walter Gropius, who led the Bauhaus from 1919 until his resignation in 1928. Although he clearly played a key role in the history of the Bauhaus, Gropius has remained a somewhat unknowable figure in the existing literature, often portrayed as a cold workaholic. It's this characterization that McCarthy challenges with a new emphasis on Gropius's relationships, both the passions of his private life and the many friendships and professional contacts that enabled him to negotiate some of the century's most turbulent decades. In the book's first section, she traces his first life from a childhood in Berlin through to Bauhaus – The development in the school is covered well, in particularly how ideas from Gropius's early career fed into the Bauhaus idea. In the following section, the book moves on to his second life in London from 1934 to 1937. Here it is the Platonic network that comes to the fore, McCarthy successfully illustrating how supporters in Britain allowed Gropius to extricate himself from Nazi Germany and continue his career into his third life in the US. In this final section, Gropius's impact on the English-speaking world is made clear. This is a valuable overview of Gropius's life. And thank you, Lucy Wassensteiner, who is a lecturer in art history at the University of Bonn, who wrote that book review, one of many that are very useful and very informative and very erudite that appear in the art newspaper. And a very different slant on art and erudition in the art newspaper of October 2019 is the following little item. The Moaning Lisa. Adult site Pornhub commissions exhibition in Los Angeles. Art and porn, are they easy bedfellows? Eyebrows may be raised at the news that Pornhub, a website that streams explicit content daily to 120 million visitors, is sponsoring a new exhibition at the Macaroni Gallery in Los Angeles called The Pleasure Principle, which runs until the 23rd of November. According to Bloomberg News, the dealer Michele Macaroni has selected the 50 works on show featuring artists and filmmakers such as Louise Bourgeois, Linda Benglis, Kathy Burkhart, Mary Beth Edelson, and Doris Wishman. Pornhub, meanwhile, has commissioned the show, paying for the production and installation costs. Macaroni says that she is interested in reclaiming this history of sexuality, specifically female sexuality, stressing also that she is pivoting to a new business model. Arousing stuff. Now, the art newspaper has another piece in its diary section, and this is about Albrecht Dürer, who was born and died in Nuremberg and lived from 1471 to 1528, and who was a painter and printmaker. And this piece is entitled Mistranslation Hits Bum Note. A mistranslation that had long led scholars to believe that Albrecht Dürer was gay has now been corrected and suggests otherwise, according to Austrian art historian Erwin Pokorny. In his catalogue essay for the Albertina's Dürer exhibition, which runs until the 6th of January 2020, a Greek inscription on a 1503 portrait sketch of German humanist Willibald Pirkheimer, who probably added the annotation, had been translated as with erect penis into the man's rectum. But Pokorny points out that the Greek phrase does not specify a male, so could equally apply to a female. Whatever Dürer's sexuality, what is certain is that he was, above all, in love with himself, Pokorny says. Aren't we all? And moving away from debating Greek translations, we move to what makes someone attack a work of art? And this comes from a list of 9 of the most audacious acts of vandalism and what inspired them. And this comes from Caroline Goldstein and was sourced on the internet on October the 2nd from news.artnet.com. And we turn to number 2 of the 9 acts of vandalism, and this is about the French sculptor Auguste Rodin. And this piece is about his sculpture, The Thinker, which is a man sitting in a pensive pose with his chin on his knuckles, and was made in 1881. And the article comes in a series of questions and answers. When and where? 1970, outside the Cleveland Museum of Art. Who done it? No one was ever arrested for the crime, but there were rumours that it was the work of the radical activist group Weather Underground. What and why? In the early morning hours of March 24, 1970, an explosion shook the large cast of Rodin's most famous sculpture, knocking off the lower legs and damaging the statue's base with the force of what authorities imagined to be 3 sticks of dynamite. Though no one was injured in the blast, the brazen act of violence brought the community, like the sculpture, to its knees. If Weather Underground is to blame, and we're just guessing here, then perhaps the radicalized group of students protesting the war in Vietnam targeted the work as a symbol of the elitism of those in power. Legacy and aftermath? Officials at the museum considered a few options after the bombing, but since it was damaged to such an extent, any alterations would have compromised the artist's original intent. In the end, the museum opted to keep what was left of the work on display without repairs, ensuring that anyone who visited would know the sad history of the pensive figure. And the vandalism rating was 5 out of 5. This piece by Caroline Goldstein does highlight the dilemma that museums and public displays have, which is greater access to things means greater vulnerability. And we'll end with something which is neither explosive nor dangerous. And this is a little piece from that excellent book, Brewer's Dictionary of Phrase and Fable, first written in 1870, and I'm reading from the 14th edition. To take one down a peg. Do you know what that one means? Well, here's the answer. To take one down a peg. To take the conceit out of a braggart or pretentious person. To lower the self-esteem. The allusion is to a ship's colours, which used to be raised and lowered by pegs. The higher the colours are raised, the greater the honour, and to take them down a peg would be to diminish the honour. An earlier explanation refers to the ancient practice of sharing drink from a pegged container down to one's allotted peg. Personally, I'm not too worried about flags, but I do rather like to have my own drink. That's all we have time for today on the Antiques Radio Show. If you have any feedback or issues you'd like to raise, please telephone 9518 8811 or email info@2rph.org.au. I'm Jolyon Warwick James and I work in the antiques industry. I have developed this program as a volunteer, unrelated to my business.